Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Please be advised the following podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and it's not appropriate for children.
With his buttocks, she turned it into steaks and roasted some bum steaks with vegetables and rosemary all seasoned. And she set up plates for his children.
James Phelps is an Australian journalist and author with a particular penchant for prisons. He's written in depth about Goulburn and Long Bay jails, which house some of Australia's most frightening men. And now he's turned his attention to Australia's women's prisons.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
James Phelps' new book, Green is the New Black, is written in his typical no-nonsense, and I have to say, pretty unsympathetic style. After recording this interview with him, Emily and I agreed we needed to hear from a former inmate for a different perspective. Luckily, I recorded an interview earlier with Kerry Tucker, and if you've ever wanted to know how a normal suburban lady could end up in prison and how she could survive there for 7 years, this is the story for you. That's coming up later, but first we start with James, and we asked him if the popularity of shows like Orange is the New Black and Wentworth had inspired him to write about women in prison.
Oh, partly. After doing, I guess, a couple of men's books on starting with Long Bay, then Goulburn, then the last one, which is a bit different. It was a collection of stories from the actual inmates. There was one hole that I had left, and that was on women. And, of course, with the popular culture at the moment, with Orange is the New Black and Wentworth,
it was probably
a good idea to try and probably dispel a few of the myths and find out what really goes in there because, obviously Orange is the New Black. They're often doing their hair and makeup and drinking tea in a common room. So I knew it was going to be a little bit different to that.
There's some pretty scary ladies in this book.
Well, it is. I mean, that's the surprise that I got. Like, I didn't think I was going to be in for the ride that I was in for. I didn't think it was going to be half as bad as what I actually encountered. I mean, I had an inkling that, you know, it wasn't going to be all too pretty, but to find out that they're mostly worse than men's jails really, really astounded me.
I have heard that before. People say women's jails are often, scarier than men's jails.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's like you can't really imagine it, but there's a reason for it, and it's because 90% of the women that go in, they go in for drug-related crimes, and most of these girls are drug addicts themselves. So if you think about it, you've got 9 out of 10 people going in, and they're either on drugs or coming down from drugs. They're quite desperate people, and, you know, they're emotional and vulnerable, and, you know, they want to get their hit or they're on it, and, you know, their propensity for violence is quite high.
So I guess probably sort of almost every time a new woman comes in, she is withdrawing and she will create dramas that then will reverberate around the unit.
Yeah, and you'd think that they're withdrawing, but a lot of them, they get it pretty quickly. I mean, if they've
got friends,
people from on the street, you know, they will get it. But, yeah, you're right. Most of them that come in, they are. And I did a story, a first-hand account from a lady called Kath Armstrong, who was a former heroin addict, and, yeah, she was throwing up and wetting herself, and it was just horrendous, and, you know, the guards are throwing her around and stuff while she was having these shocking withdrawals, and, you know, but it only took her 2 days to get her first hit of heroin when she was in there.
Wow. I mean, if you had to choose the scariest woman that you've written about, which one would it be?
Oh, undisputed. It's not just scariest woman, it's scariest person, and that's Rebecca Butterfield.
Okay.
I thought Catherine Knight, but...
Yeah, me too. Rebecca, I thought you were going to... Yeah, okay, we'll come to Catherine.
Don't get me wrong, I wouldn't want to go to a barbecue with Catherine Knight.
No, you wouldn't.
Tell us about Rebecca Butterfield.
Yeah, Rebecca, she's not a name that most people would know.
No.
She's not famous or infamous on the outside, but she certainly is on the inside. She started off... first went to jail for some pretty minor offences compared to a lot of them, and that was, she threw a bottle at a police car, then she went in the first time, second time she stabbed the neighbour, not too badly, but, yeah, obviously it's not a very nice thing, but when she gets to jail that she becomes this animal. They call her the Hannibal Lecter of the Australian prison system. And she was in there for a couple of years, and she murdered a lady. She stabbed her 32 times with a kitchen knife.
Why?
And it was a fatal attraction. She fancied the girl.
Oh.
And the inmates say that she started doing her hair the same way and wearing her clothes in the same manner. You don't have a lot of freedom to, you know, dress differently. But, you know, she was copying the little things that she did, like tying the jumper around the certain way she did it. And obviously she didn't have success forming a relationship with her, and she stabbed her to death because of it. And that's not even the bad part. This is where she gets bad. Then she becomes a serial self-harmer. So she starts trying to hurt herself, or she does hurt herself every occasion possible so she can get the attention of officers and medical staff. And as soon as she comes into contact with them, she attacks them.
Oh.
So we're talking about she headbutted a wall 101 times, and you know, she damaged herself to the point that she had grey matter oozing from her head.
Oh, my God. Brain? She had brain coming out of her head?
Yeah, there was brain, bits of brain on the wall.
Oh, my God.
She tried to chop her head off with a toilet seat, slamming it through. She's got things called open wounds, which are wounds that don't close. They've been opened up that many times that the cells won't bond together.
So she's just having infections all the time or something.
Yeah, it's absolutely hideous. And I mean, she does this because she wants attention. And as soon as a guard walks into her cell, she'll attack them. She's thrown urine at guards, boiling water.
Well, the question has to be asked, is prison the place for this lady? I mean, should she be in a hospital?
Well, that's the next bit. She's the only inmate in Australia to be kept past her maximum sentence that isn't deemed to have a psychotic condition. So she's actually deemed sane.
What?
So she can't be put in that sort of care. But that's where she made history. No one's ever been kept past their maximum date, except for her, without a psychotic disorder.
So, hang on. She's sane, according to...
Well, that's... Legally. Yes, according to the doctors and nurses and everyone that have inspected her, obviously she's got some, you know, disorders, but basically, you know, I don't think being psychotic is an actually diagnosable medical condition.
But trying to cut your head off with a toilet seat, I mean, if that doesn't tick the boxes... I don't know.
So do they just keep Rebecca by herself all the time? Like, how do they manage her?
She's in what's called an observation cell. So it's basically a perspex cage where you can see in at all times. She has to be monitored at all times. And in there's absolutely nothing that she could use as a weapon or potentially to harm herself. But, obviously padded walls and everything now that she's invented headbutting concrete.
This
is a lady that's tried to eat fluorescent lights.
Oh my God, this poor woman. And this came out of, you know, really minor initial offences. Do you have any idea about her background, her childhood, where this could come from?
She's actually the daughter of a police officer.
Oh
she
my
lived
God.
Out Bathurst Way. And there's some indication that this neighbour may have sexually abused her at some point.
Okay.
And she formed this hatred for the police. So whether or not that had something to do with it, but apparently it's because they wouldn't take her complaint seriously. And that's why she began hurling bottles and stuff at police cars in the local area. And then she stabbed, I think, the partner of this man to get herself into jail. So,
and it sounds to me like she just feels hopeless. And, you know, with every sort of new action, she creates more hopelessness for herself. Well, I wouldn't feel sorry for her.
I wouldn't feel sorry. No, she's...
I don't want to go in there and tell her face-to-face, but, you know.
No, she's the person that every single officer in the system is terrified of. You know, they describe her as pure evil.
How do the officers manage her if they have to actually come, like, into contact with her? How do they ensure their safety?
Very carefully. Like, they've got a list of protocols, and basically she's very manipulative, so... You know, she tries to gain your confidence and might seem very calm and, you know, come over here and check this. So they've just all warned just to, you know, go through these protocols with her, never be sucked into what she's doing. And, you know, if you have to use force, use it. So often she does have force used upon her. But she's an exceptional case and certainly not the norm. And
what a tragedy. You know. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've written about, I think, someone who's at the other end of the spectrum, former penthouse pet Victoria Shembri. Who is known as the most glamorous inmate in Silverwater Women's Correctional Centre. Tell us about the lovely Victoria.
Yeah, well, I had to find myself I guess, your average woman. So I really needed to put everyone that's reading the book in a situation where it could be you. The closest I could find was Victoria Shembury, and she was actually in for 4 years for tax fraud. So it was a couple of hundred grand she embezzled through a partner. But, you know, she's a good-looking girl. She was very average, never done drugs in her life, wasn't a drinker, well-spoken. And for me, she was the perfect fit to sort of follow around on her journey. And we've done that throughout the book.
Okay.
And, yeah, it's quite incredible. Like, the first day she went in, she sat there watching in a police holding cell a woman who happened to be on a period pulling a little case of drugs out the front end, if I could say.
And, got it,
Yep, and sat there in the cell handing these ecstasy pills out to all the other inmates to try and win them over and gain some credit before she went into jail. And that was her first experience. And then when she actually arrived at Mullawa, which is the worst of the women's jails, she had women straight up to her, touching her hair, peeling her skin, saying, "You're beautiful, honey. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, you're gorgeous. How do you get your skin so soft?" And
is sexual... I'm going to say sexual assault, but I know that that's not what you're speaking about specifically right now. But is sexual assault a big issue in women's prisons?
I wouldn't say sexual assault, but it was certain propositions. So for Victoria, the case was a woman came up and said, "Look, you're going to get, you know, really, really picked on here. The only way you can be safe is be my girlfriend." And
so her beauty made her very vulnerable.
Yeah, and she knocked that back, and as a result, she was bashed 4 or 5 times, ended up in hospital during her time there, but she decided to stand alone. But what you'll find in women's jail is a huge majority of them are in sexual relationships. So, again, we're talking in the vicinity of 8, 9 out of 10, and it's not forced upon them, and not all these girls are homosexual. They choose to enter these relationships, one, for protection, which you could probably understand. They just do it for their own safety. And the other one, which I found quite fascinating, was a lot of girls that don't consider themselves to be lesbians will enter that sort of relationship because they want a bit of physicality. They want to be touched. They want some emotional support.
Yeah, I get that. Gay for the stay is the term that they use in American prisons, I think.
Yeah. But it does go on in men's jails as well, but certainly not to the extent that it does in the women's jails.
Well, we were just talking the other day about the Maria Korp case, and of course, the lady who was convicted of that murder, Tanya, she came out of prison in a gay relationship and was picked up by a former cellmate who was then her partner. I think they were engaged and all that. Do these relationships tend to last after jail?
Some of them do, and I mean, in the book, I've got a fascinating case about a prisoner called Kathy Yeo, who is in for life. She chopped her boyfriend's head off and chucked it in the Cooks River in Sydney.
Did she?
Yeah, she ended up in a relationship with a prison officer, a female prison officer. And this female prison officer obviously got found out for what she was doing and she quit. And, you know, a month later she was rocking up to visits as a civilian to visit her girlfriend, Kathy Yeo. And I believe that relationship's still ongoing.
Well, why not, I suppose? Most of us meet partners at work. So
yeah, she quit for love.
Yeah,
it's a big call.
Good on her. I'm just reading about Tracy Lee Brannigan, also from your book, who died of a heroin overdose in her cell at Mullawa Prison. We all know, I'm not naive, we all know there's lots of drugs in prison, but that's a bad look for the prison system, isn't it?
It is, and I documented this case because it was public and it shows exactly, you know, how this stuff goes on and to the extent. But, yeah, an overdose, she was locked in a cell at 4 p.m. with an amount of drugs and... yeah, took too much and died with a lover in the cell with her. And, you know, a lot of blame went on after this. People were accusing officers that are warned that, you know, she was having a problem and they were saying it was their fault. And the officers obviously were saying, well, no, we didn't know she had drugs. We didn't expect her to do that. It gets in. And, I mean, one of my favourite stories that I've got in the book is the extent that they go to hide it. And this isn't actually hiding it, but it's hiding the presence of it. So they are randomly drug tested in prison, and a lot of the times they come up clean, which is what prison authorities say, well, look, we don't have a problem. They're testing clean. They're not taking drugs. But they've come up with this ingenious device, which Lance Armstrong might have had to think about back in his day. But it's called a bodgie. And what it is they get a mum deodorant bottle lid. Now, apparently it's Consort. To the right specs for comfort, and they will urinate in that or they'll get actually the clean women in the jail, that 10%.
Yeah.
They'll stand over them and get them to take it to the toilet. And then they get given out dental dams in prison for safe oral sex. They'll use that to put over the top of the bottle to hold the urine in. And a little rubber band or a bit of string goes around it. Then they insert that in themselves and they'll carry it around 24 hours a day. And when they're asked to provide a sample, it's simply a case of slipping a fingernail in and breaking that dental dam.
Yes.
And they'll have the clean sample.
That's like a lot of thought goes into that.
Well, I suppose you've got all day to think about stuff.
That's true. That's,
that's ingenious. It has to be said.
It's ingenious.
And that's where female prisoners have it over male prisoners, I think, to a certain extent. We have an extra storage facility. Would that be fair to say, James?
Oh, I'm glad you went there, not me, but it's called the smelly safe. That's what it's called. Or
is it?
The hairy handbag.
I feel like my mind is being blown talking about this stuff today. Like, we just don't know about this stuff.
Do you get much blowback from, you know, I mean, increasingly in this world, you can't say anything without someone being offended and letting you know. But in particular, even in this conversation, you've talked about, oh, most of the girls are junkies and, you know, they're all coming down or they're all on drugs or whatever. And as you speak, I think, oh, God, I'm glad he's saying that, not me. I wouldn't want to deal with this on Facebook. Do you get much blowback from people?
No, not really. I think it's because it's fact. I mean, this is all documented.
That doesn't stop people, incidentally. But
people who don't care about the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah, look, I mean, if you want to be honest, you've got to sometimes, you know, walk that fine line between being politically correct and not. And, you know, I've been taught just to say it how it is. And
I guess in jail people are pretty straight talking. I can't imagine there'd be a lot of,
Yes and no. Like, the last book was called Inmates, and I let the inmates have their say. And there's a reason for that, is because, you know, sometimes their stories are a little bit different to what the officers and the official stories are, and that might be because they're talking themselves up or glorifying their crimes and things like that. So you've got to find a bit of a medium. So anything you're told by an inmate, you want to check it with another inmate, you want to double check it with some guards, whatever records you can find, and, you know, you'll find the common ground. But I've done that with all the sort of stories that are mentioned throughout my books. They're all triple and sometimes four times checked.
Yeah, I bet. I noticed that you say that Catherine Knight, who we spoke about briefly before, is affectionately known as Grandma at Silverwater Prison.
Yeah, talk us through Catherine Knight's offence first, please.
Oh, rightio. I hope, you know, no one's got their breakfast on their stomachs. But she had a partner at the time, and I think they were broken up or getting back together. It was a volatile relationship. And anyway, something happened on one particular evening and she went and slept over his house. And they made love that night. And sometime after that, she murdered him. Now, Catherine Knight worked in an abattoir. She was a skilled butcher. So she went to work on the partner after she killed him. Now, she skinned him, first of all, and decapitated him. She put his skin suit hanging off a hook near the lounge room and kitchen on display. And then with the rest of his headless torso skinned, she stuck it in a lounge chair and put a beer bottle and a remote control in his hand. And then with the rest of the body, she decided to cook it. So she cooked the head. She made a stew out of it. With his buttocks, she turned it into steaks and roasted some bum steaks with vegetables and rosemary all seasoned. Oh, and she set up plates for his children. Now, they weren't her children, but children's with place cards. And at some point during the night, she's fallen asleep and the police have been alerted because there was blood on the door and his car was there. He should have been at work and they got there before, obviously, the children came home. But there was a bit of meat that had been chewed and some vomit near it. So they believe that Catherine Knight actually ate a bit of the partner and probably couldn't stomach it. But anyway, that was the crime. And the backstory is she says she can't remember doing it. She doesn't deny she did it. Obviously, there's a lot of evidence and she accepts that. And if you're looking for a reason, there's some loose indication that she believed he'd sexually abused some children at some point. They're all unfounded, all alleged. And that was her issue.
They had, you said they had a volatile relationship. I remember from reading, he was always drawn back to her. She sort of, even though she, you look at photos of her and she doesn't look like a particularly alluring woman, but she had some sort of charm over men. Well, she used sex as a weapon.
Well,
essentially.
It's not just charm over men, and it's not just sex. She has this charm over all the other inmates at Mulawa.
Wow.
They call it the Nena. And she runs a whole wing, and like a matron figure, and she doesn't run it through enforcing or fear. She's never laid a hand on anybody. She's not aggressive. She does it because they genuinely have affection for her and respect her. And, you know, she's a this little old figure that does crochet in her room and makes artwork for the fellow inmates. Spoken to a number of inmates that have artworks on their fridge from Catherine Knight that she's done for their children. One of them's a picture of Bart Simpson signed to the child.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I just feel like disturbed listening to this.
Oh my God, it's incredible. How do female prisons differ from male prisons in your experience?
Smaller. They're much smaller. Obviously, the rate of incarceration is far less.
Uh-huh.
And as I said, the drugs, that's another big thing. Like, you might have 20% of the male system that are still taking out the drugs. Women's, it's up to 90%.
So right?
Totally different type
so
of that.
So it's more drug offences why women are in there.
Yeah, 100%. Okay. You don't have the sort of gangster type figures or the car rebirthing syndicates or these high level career criminals. Most of them committed crimes to support their drug habit. And then also the next one is obviously your assaults and murders and their crimes of passion mostly.
I remember when I worked as a brothel receptionist years ago, James, and this lady was going back into jail, and she was going in for shoplifting offences. And she said, and I remember she was in the girls' room where they put their bags and had lockers and that, and she was on the phone in there, the payphone, organising her life for the 3 months that she'd be away. And she said, oh, God, I can't wait. It's just such a break. Did you notice much of that? She said, you know, I go in there, I've got no bills, my kids are with someone else, and I'm fed every day, and I don't have to work as a sex worker, for example. And, you know, she was looking forward to it.
Yeah, for some. And I recently was speaking to a lady that told me her friend just got caught on purpose. So she walked into his 7-Eleven and, you know, stole a bunch of chocolates and whatever. And this was just before the start of winter. She was homeless. She lived on the street. And she did that she could go to jail for the winter. These people that do that, they've been in and out of the system their whole lives. So they're familiar with it. They're familiar. They'll know people once they get in. I mean, if you're going in for the first time and you don't have any associates, well, you're going to get bashed. You're going to get, you know, stood over.
Is that just a given? You just like, if Michelle or I walked in one day had no people, we wouldn't stand a chance, basically.
Yep, 100%. You'd have to, you know, find someone you knew. And if you didn't know anyone, you'd have to do it on your own. And straight away, you'd have four or five women come up to you and try and steal your shoes or your cigarettes. Well, I don't have cigarettes anymore, but your credit, your phone calls, whatever. So
I shouldn't plan it as a break.
No.
That's James Phelps, whose latest book, Green is the New Black, is available now. And coming up next, we chat with former prisoner Kerry Tucker.
What's going on?
Oh, it's Chrissy. Found her cutting up her clothes. Next thing, she's cutting up her hair.
Well, we had to forcibly restrain her. Don't give us that, Smith. You two, no television for 2 nights. The governor wants to see you.
I don't care what the rest of you bitches do in this funny farm. I just want my own space. Get it? Because you haven't got what it takes!
Well, I hope for your sake I have.
He used to give me roses. I wish he could again.
Ah, prisoner. Or Cell Block H for those of you who watched in the UK, where it was a huge hit.
And things were different then. On the inside, the sun still shines. The sun and rain are prisoners too. When morning comes around. Last night I dreamed.
I must admit, the denim uniforms and industrial dryers are still what I imagine when I think about women's prison. But Kerry Tucker, author, academic and advocate, has a much more realistic perspective. She spent 7 years in prison, but she really did not fit the drug-addicted career criminal stereotype we've heard about.
So I was just a normal mum of two young daughters. At the time, it's such a long time ago now, I was very desperately unhappy. I also had no idea that I was suffering from dissociative identity disorder, which is previously named multiple personality disorder.
Really?
I had no idea of that, but I guess that's the general point of it. So
yeah.
On the scale, when I, my forensic psychiatrist, when I went to prison, on the scale I was 7 out of 10, so I was sort of just stopping short of naming the other personalities and having them dress in different clothes.
Well, this is okay. Now, I had no idea about this, so this is a whole other issue. So you, I would say a lot of people find themselves in prison with mental illness.
Absolutely.
And probably a lot of them, it's the first they've known of it. So looking back now, how was that actually working in your life before your arrest? How was your disassociative, is that what it's called? Dissociative identity disorder.
Yes. I actually couldn't tell you how it was working because I wasn't aware of it.
Yeah.
What I was aware of was people saying to me, which Kerry is this today? You know, what was that for? Why did you say that? You're so different today. I would remember, you know, driving from Hillsville to Ringwood, which is, say, a 45-minute drive, and I'd be filling up with petrol and then all of a sudden I'd stand there and think, how did I get here? You know, I didn't remember the drive as such. So there were little cracks that I could relate to.
Yeah.
I initially thought my forensic psychiatrist, who was such a lovely, lovely man, was saying this just because he liked me and wanted me to get a better sentence. And when I told this to him, he said, no, you really are crazy.
Wow.
So, but I didn't know this, but everybody around me sort of did. They weren't surprised at all that, you know, I was diagnosed with this.
I've done a little bit of reading about it in the past, and isn't it generally to do with pretty extreme childhood trauma?
Yes, yeah. From what I was advised, it's certainly from traumatic experiences where your personality splits. Mine split into stages rather than personalities as such. I was sort of just nudging that. So I had different personality types that would rear up in different circumstances, self-destructive, rescuer, that sort of stuff. So, and that became very evident in prison as well. In fact, it probably helped me.
Yeah. So you hadn't named the personalities at that stage?
No, no.
Do you remember what the trauma was that split your personality?
Not overly, no, no.
Wow.
No.
Do you want to? Is that part of
you? No, I have no desire to delve into that. I think some things can often be left left, you know, in the background. I don't see why we have to relive it to be able to come to terms with it, because in my mind, if I don't know about it, then I've got nothing to grapple with. The other thing is, you know, memory can be a really difficult thing. So, you know, unless I know that it happened, I might convince myself that something else happened. So I really don't know, and I'm way past worrying about that.
Yeah, there's a lot of writing about that, isn't there?
There certainly is.
The sort of lost memories that are retrieved sometimes weren't memories at all.
Exactly, and I've seen that in prison. It's a very, very easy thing to get into, and I, you know, it's somewhere I don't want to get into. My life is very factual. It's very open, so I don't want to bring in anything that I'm certainly not sure of or that may appear made up, you know, because I can't dispute it. I have no memory of it. And that's for quite a long period of time. But interestingly enough, after spending 2 years in a maximum security prison, the forensic psychiatrist came out to assess me just before my trial, and I didn't score on the dissociative identity, you know, scale at all. So it took going into a maximum security prison and having the role that I had to be able to heal, to start to heal myself.
So before all of that, you were working at the sawmill?
Yeah, well, for friends in the office.
Right, and that is where you were siphoning cash from?
Yep absolutely.
Yeah. How much was it?
Well, it was, I went to prison for $1.9 million. That's, you know. Yeah, that's in my mind disputable, but there was never a forensic accountant involved, you know, with working it out, but that's what it is. So you can't cry over spilt milk.
No. And so did you plan to start stealing from the people you were working for who were also friends of yours?
No, I didn't. Absolutely not. It was, it became a force of habit, I guess. It made, it made a very desperate, unhappy situation a lot easier. And when you're when you're in a desperate situation, it's really, really easy. It's not a big step to make desperate decisions and really bad decisions. And then you just, you know, if you're used to living in a hostile environment, it's very easy to justify it in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that's what you want to do. You don't want to feel bad about what you're doing. So you justify it.
Yeah.
And that's why it becomes a habit.
So was it the hostile environment, was that your marriage when you were in a bad marriage?
Well, it was an unhappy marriage. Yeah.
Okay. So you're unhappy and to make yourself happy, you were finding little bits of extra money to send across into your account.
Yep. And anything that would make everything okay. Mm-hmm. So there was no hiccups along the way. So no bills, no financial problems, things like that.
I can sort of understand how that would work. So, you know, a couple of days ago we realised our shower was leaking, you know. So then all of a sudden you've got this big expense you weren't planning. And I can understand how you might sort of think, oh, if I could just nip that across there. And
with the intention
of paying it back.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, there's never an intention to hurt. You know, normal people don't just wake up and decide, today I'm going to go and, you know, commit crime.
Yeah.
Today I'm going to take advantage of friends or of a bank account or whatnot, or I might just go and rob a bank because I need to do this. It's a slippery slide. It's something that you find yourself in and then you start looking for ways out of it.
Mm.
And if opportunities arise in the way that you are and the way you're thinking, this is where it's very easy to make really bad decisions.
So you slide a little bit of money across with the intention of paying it back, but then no one notices. The business is still going great guns. It's nothing to them compared to what's coming in and going out. So then something else pops up and you think, just one more time. I'll just slide a bit across.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And that keeps going and going and going. And that's a normal, you know, I do a lot of speaking about around white collar crime, and that's a normal way of thinking. It's a normal way. And while you're in control of that, you have that, you know, that mindset that, you know, well, it's okay. Sooner or later, something's going to happen where I'll be able to fix this.
Yep.
Yeah.
But what did happen in the end? How did it – what stopped it?
The company went broke.
Right.
So, yeah, the company went broke and the police were brought in. I was aware that the police were involved, and it was literally only about 4 weeks later that I was at the gym and they came and arrested me.
The gym.
Yeah, it was lovely.
So they arrested you straight away. They didn't question you first.
No. They were very, very hostile. And look, I don't blame them. That's their job. I have no problems with the police in that sense. But they walked in, guns drawn. This is factual, in a gym at 6 a.m.
Wow.
And
you're not accused of a violent crime.
No. And from that moment on, I wasn't allowed to contact anyone. They took my mobile phone off me. I was taken back straight back to the station. I was kept there for an hour, and then I was taken back out to Hillsville where there was a truck waiting out the front of the house. There were about, I would say, 15 policemen there from different parts of the force, and they just gutted the house of furniture and the kids' Christmas, everything. And then they took me back to the station, and I was there for about 9 hours, I guess, being interviewed, and we went from there.
So are they sort of cataloguing all your possessions?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
To sell them or like what's the...
Restitution, you know. Yeah. I hadn't been charged at this stage. I hadn't even been interviewed, so... They were very. I'd been under surveillance, you know, apparently for 4 weeks, which was just a waste. You know, I wasn't going anywhere. I was very aware that the police were doing their investigation. The gig was up. Mm. You know, I wasn't about to run anywhere, and you know, I was arrested, you know, and put on daily reporting. They were very. I was a master criminal.
Wow.
Yeah.
But at home. You know, you were mum to two young girls.
Yeah.
When did they find out that this was happening? At what time during that first day?
I actually said, because they'd taken my phone off me, I actually said to them, you know, I need to ring my ex-husband. My children are at, you know, the childcare centre and one, I think, was in grade one. They need to be picked up. And surprisingly, I was told that, you know, unless I confessed, they would have two uniformed policemen go up to the childcare centre and the school and put the children in foster care. I had no idea that you couldn't do that.
Mm.
So I absolutely confessed. I was going to anyway. You know, it was quite obvious I wasn't. You know, I made them all coffee while they're at my house because it was very uncomfortable, you know. And it was what it was. So then my ex-husband was advised and he was able to go and collect the children. So it started really from that point.
My God. And how did they? How were they in those early days? When did you? Because they're very young. When did they?
They were 5 and 7, I think.
When were they told what was going on with you?
Their father pretty much did most of that. I skirted around the issue. It's really difficult, regardless of, you know, the fact that you've committed crime. It is really difficult looking into the eyes of your baby daughters and saying, I know I'm going away.
Yeah.
I'm leaving you. You know, it's probably the hardest thing any mother could do under any circumstances.
And that is really big in that first series of Wentworth.
Oh, it's huge. And this
character of Bea trying to get in touch with her child and the blocks that are put in her way. And it's heartbreaking to watch.
And that, you know, in Wentworth, what Bea goes through was based on all my diaries, everything that I diarised. I've got over 1 million words of when I was in prison. So the first series is where what we really wanted to establish was the story behind the women.
Yeah.
You know, where these women come from. You know, just about every woman in prison was a victim of a crime before they became a perpetrator of a crime. That's not an excuse. It's a fact. And the women in prison don't go, well, that's what happened, you know. They just get on with it, you know. Most of them are domestic violence, you know, victims. So they're used to accepting blame. They're used to just getting on with it, you know. So this is what women do. They're very tough and you become quite tough in there. So trying to contact your children and have a relationship with them when you're in prison is really, really difficult. And I go to great pains to say it's not us women as criminals saying, you know, well, they're my children. What we're actually saying is it's the children's right to see their mother. You know, it's so, so, so important.
Yeah. Even in that environment.
Absolutely. The environment is really, really friendly. You know, there's a visit centre with toys. It's very upbeat. The prison recognises, and I was there under the general manager, Brendan Money, who's one of the most fabulous men that, you know, I ever had the privilege of being a prisoner with. But he understood all of that. He understood that the children needed their mothers. It's a very, very safe environment. I had to convince my ex-husband first. We've never been involved with prisons before.
Yeah.
So
I'd take some convincing if someone asked me to take my kids into a prison.
He was very apprehensive. He, you know, we fought on and off about it as you know, and then, you know, at one point, you know, he decided that it was too unsafe. And I said to him, you know, this is in a visit centre and whatnot. He thought that, you know, the kids would come in and they'd wander the compound and have barbecues with the armed robbers and things like that. And it was, you know, I said to him, you know, we don't have barbecues with armed robbers because they always knock off the meat. It's just that simple. So they never take the salads. It's always the meat. So, you know, there was never any fear of that. But, you know, there were some really good programs in prison where, you know, the staff would come in, they get very involved with the children, they take photos, there's games. It's a very bright area for mum and the kids, very safe. And the kids get used to it. My kids, you know, they had to. They got used to the officers. They got to know. The only thing that was a bit of a concern was when they bring the dogs in. That's very, very scary. And that was what prompted me to write the children's book, you know, so that when somebody on the outside, like my ex-husband, is looking at having to go into a prison, he can sit down. It's a colouring book. He can sit down and read it with them and take them through the steps. And it has helped a lot of women to be able to see their children. Forget about the women in this sense. It's the children that need to know that they haven't been deserted. You know, we'll put up with what we have to. We'll get on with it. But, you know, our children are the innocent victims as well.
What do you remember of the first day that you arrived in prison?
The prison was full. So I was taken to the Moorabbin Police holding cells, which is probably the equivalent of Guantanamo Bay. In the sense that, you know, it's sort of I can't remember the outside of it at all, but I do remember that the lights were left on all the time. So after a while, I couldn't work out whether it was daylight or dark. I didn't know what time it was, what day it was. We were there for nearly a month. Of a morning, they just get up and it was May, so it was freezing. And it was concrete. We couldn't have shoes. They would literally get a fire hose and just wash it out each morning.
Wow.
It was really, really bad, but it toughened me up, ready for for the big girl school. and I was in there with girls that had, you know, that had been to prison many, many times. So I got to know them very, very well, and in fact helped them. My very first letter I did for them was in the cells, with a little piece of paper on some toilet paper, and got it out.
You so wrote a letter for somebody?
For the girls that were already in there. Wow. Because they were being, you know, they were being treated really, really badly. Now, I get it's a dreadfully, dreadfully hard job for the officers. I really do. It's not nice. But, you know, the women aren't doing it very well either, you know. Mm. So, and to lock them down even further as a discipline was just stupid, just ridiculous, you know. We had pregnant women in there, and it was just unsafe. So, you know, I that was the first time I represented the girls in getting somebody out. I can't remember what she was, the people that look after prison, after the police cells anyway.
Yeah.
I can't remember who she, what her name was. But, so she came out and interviewed the girls, and they felt heard. After that, the girls were fine.
Mm.
It's just a matter of being heard,
mm.
you know. So so after that, I was then transferred out to the prison, and I can assure you the prison is much better in facilities as such, because you actually got a blanket.
Yeah.
And
you went straight to the, what is it, the
Dame Phyllis Frost Centre. That's Victoria's maximum security prison.
Yes.
It replaced Fairlie.
Oh, yep, Fairlie Women's Prison. Yep. I remember that, yes.
The Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, when I was there, it housed around about 200. They've now built more cells. So it houses around about 300, 320 now.
Mm.
And everyone goes there. It's not like the men's prisons where they have remand and high security, minimum security, and maximum security. We just have the one, so okay. Everyone's in together. You know, that can be quite daunting. You know, for particularly for young people. I guess it was arriving there, and when I arrived, I actually it was late, and the prison was locked down. I didn't realize how it worked. Someone had lost some keys or something, so I was walked up to a unit where I was to spend the first night because that was the room that was available. When I got up next morning, I realised it very quickly that it was the unit for the criminally insane.
Wow.
And I didn't know whether I was there because I was insane, or whether I was there because there was a mistake, or whether I was there waiting to go somewhere else. I had no idea.
And I guess part of it is that they're low on info. They don't tell you much, right?
And it was late. It was very, very late, yeah. So I had no idea. I just remember thinking.
So how did you figure it out when you woke up? Was it the sounds of the place?
Yeah, and the women and their behaviour.
Yeah, okay. You were allowed out to socialise with the other women there?
One of the most frightening things is getting there really, really late at night, and then the next morning they open up the door. That's it, you're out. You're out. And so I was in the unit with, you know, at that time it was basically for the criminally insane. And you know, it was quite an eye-opener. Then I spent about 3 days there before a bed became available in the remand unit. The remand unit within the prison is a prison within a prison. It holds 52 women. There's 26 on either side. It's like walking through a Bosnian minefield and just hoping something doesn't blow up.
Mm.
It's the most hostile part because everyone that arrives there generally goes there first.
Mm.
And they're put under observation before they're put out onto the main compound.
So everyone's tense, nervous.
Withdrawing,
of course.
Yep. Withdrawing from
drugs.
Yep.
And I suppose, do people really, we sort of joke about it, do people really go to prison with a sort of a strategy as to, like, do you pump yourself up a bit to try and appear scary because you're scared? Not you personally, but do people do that?
I think initially, no.
Right.
When you've been there a few times, you've got a bit of everyone remembers you over time. But when you first arrive there, no, it is you're literally making sure that you don't upset somebody, that you watch, you know, what's going on. I spent a long time working out the dynamics. You know, what was who I had to watch out for, what was happening. Most of the time there, the women were withdrawing, and there's not a lot of help for them. You know, it's a really, really horrible thing to see. And when someone can't look after themselves, it's almost impossible to walk past them and just say no. So these were women that coming in at about 48 kilos, you know, and desperately, desperately ill. But that's no concern really of the prison. They have to be completely and utterly, you know, ready for hospital before anything will be done. They're left to withdraw themselves. So the girls have a camaraderie where they look after each other and make sure that, you know, they've got – I think I was amazed. I was thinking to myself, I remember going up and having to steal some cordial so that this girl could get some sugar into her. And I was so proud of myself that I managed to go into the kitchen of a maximum security prison and steal this inch of cordial and whatnot. And I was walking away thinking, wow, I'm in here for $1.9 million. And I couldn't feel more proud at the moment. scampering back with the cordial to give this girl, you know.
How many women do you think who went to prison have a drug addiction?
Oh, 70% at any time, you know. And I had not come from, it was the best drug education I ever had.
Yeah.
You know, I had never had any drug issues and whatnot. So, seeing the girls and hearing their stories, you know, most of them, their primary school age was working on the streets and being raped every other day, you know.
Yeah.
Sexual abuse, it's just insane, you know. And behind these women are really, really lovely girls. And this was what I had the privilege of seeing. Some of them are bad.
Yeah.
Some of them just should be there and stay there. But that's not by far and above, that's not the majority of women there. And that was, again, what we tried to do in Wentworth, the first season, you know, was to show that these women aren't, you know, the prison isn't just about these animals locked away that have got no social skills, because what that does is then causes a community to think, well, they're right where they should be.
Yep.
You know, and that's just silly, because every woman gets out. And in my mind, if I'm getting out and I'm going to live next door to you, Wouldn't you hope that while I was in prison, we did everything we could to make me a better person?
Yeah, definitely.
It's just so simple in my mind. Mm. And seeing it from the inside as I have, and seeing it from the, you know, the outside as well, it makes even more sense that you invest instead of, you know, it's not sexy for politicians to say, I'm going to put money in prisons, you mm-hmm. know, which is just silly, absolutely silly.
Speaking of sexy, by the way, both Wentworth and Orange is the New Black.
Yep.
Portray a lot of sex
yes.
in the prison. Yep. Is that yep. true?
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's, you know, there's a lot of different, you know, relationships as far as sex goes in prison.
Gay for the stay.
Yeah.
I've heard about that one. That's where you're not gay on the yep. outside, but yep. inside, sure.
The other one for gay for the stay or gate gays.
Gate gays.
So what happens is that once you arrive at the prison, you all of a sudden become gay.
Right.
Yeah, and when you leave, you go back to your boyfriend.
Yep.
There are a lot of women in there that had relationships with other women. And I used to sit and talk to them and say, you know, you got a boyfriend and whatnot. But they wanted, it wasn't about the sex. It was about having a loving relationship. Mm. It was about that sort of stuff. So I would say half of it was about just having a nurturing relationship with somebody. The other half of it was just rampant sex. But you get that anywhere, you know. It's, yep. it's just... The average stay is probably around 3 years, you know. Women Whoa. Are women.
Yeah, yeah. Well, humans are humans. Yeah,
it's exactly right. So
what happens when the prison realises there's a relationship going on? Do they – is they it allowed or
– Well, when I was there, they just sort of tended to turn a blind eye, you know. There was no – it wasn't openly – you know, girls yeah. would walk around maybe hand in hand, but you wouldn't see them having sex in the middle of the compound, you know. So if they were caught and it was somewhere public, you know, they'd be given a stern talking to. But other than that, you know, I think the officers there, you know, some of them – I only had an issue with one or two officers, you know.
Yeah.
The rest of them I thought were fabulous, you know, the way they dealt with women. They're different in the sense that, you know, they have a six-week training course, so – they related to a lot of the women. They would turn a blind eye to that sort of stuff anyway, you know, which is because it's just a natural thing. Mm. Then there are other women in there, you know, that are just like myself that was heterosexual, and there's women in there that are, they're 15 years that wouldn't even think of it, you know. So it's just an amazing dynamic in there. It's a fascinating, fascinating place.
Yeah. In the series Wentworth, one of those early moments that Bea really thinks, where the hell am I, is when she swings around her doorway and that stunning girl who plays Frankie.
Yes, Nicole.
Is just going hell for leather with another girl in her bed. Yep. And she just kind of looks up and looks Bea in the eye.
Yep.
And it's a really powerful moment. Do you remember that moment for you in terms of that moment
it was
where you
exactly
thought,
that moment.
Was it really that?
Yes.
Wow.
This is how much, you know, I say about Wentworth being noticed. It was literally that moment. And because as much as, you know, Frankie and Bea and whatnot, they're all, and Lizzie, they're all based on the prisoner people.
Yeah.
Because they've been re-imaged for the characters. They're also based on the real women in prison that were focal around me. And interestingly enough, they all slip into that because when it first aired, the girls from prison were Facebooking me and saying, you know, wow, I know who that is. That's that, you know.
I bet.
And my biggest concern was that they, you know, that I didn't disrespect them. Mm. And they loved the first series, you know. So that was exactly my, you know, I opened it and you know, I won't say who the woman was, but, you know, after that, she was, you know, pretty keen, pretty interested, you know, in me, and I was like, this is going to be great.
Was it scary?
Yes, it was because
suburban lady from Healesville, and
I really didn't want to upset this girl because for a moment there I thought she was a man. Anyway,
wow, okay.
So, but we actually became friends, you know, and I remember at one point, you know, my first day there, and I was like, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking to myself, oh, I've been married. Not much scares me anymore. You know, if I can get through a marriage, any woman can get through a marriage. Yep. Prison's got to be easy. So, but one of the first days, there was a prisoner who'd been there, and she was very well known to the system and very well connected. And she came up and she said to me, give us your smokes. I went, oh, no, not really. No, I'm pretty keen to have one myself.
Mm.
And she, you know, long and short of it was that she was, you know, well, why don't we go outside? And I'm like, oh, no, thanks. I'm quite okay in here. She said, let's go outside. She said, and I just looked at her and went, I just gave up. I thought I'm in the worst place ever. I'm at there's no lower you can go apart from death.
Yep.
And I was standing there, I'm looking at this big woman and I said to her, look, you know, we can go outside. You know, I'm not going to win. There is no doubt about this, but you're as sure as shit going to know you've been in a fight. You know, it was my only, and it was all mouth. I didn't mean that at all, but I'd heard it in a movie.
Wow.
And it just came to me, and she just looked at me and went, and everyone's watching then going, oh, what are we going to do? And she just looked at me and said, you're crazy, and walked off. And I thought, So I was onto that from the word go.
Yeah.
You know.
You've got to have that bravado.
And, you know, look, I am not a shrinking violet, you know, so I was able to use that. The other thing is I have a bit of a sharp tongue when I need to have it. And no woman likes to look or be made a fool of in the compound. So if I found myself in a difficult situation, I'd make sure it was right in the compound.
Yeah.
And I had the ability to make them make a tough girl look stupid. And no one wanted that, so they'd sort of go. After a while, I started doing all of their parole letters and things like that. So I became their trusted confidant, you know, and very handy in that sense.
Yeah, because you weren't as marginalised as most women in there. You know, you hadn't come from an easy life, but certainly you're very well educated. You're very smart. You're very well spoken. You have a confidence about you, and you have real leadership skills. So how did you start to use those skills and sort of make a life for yourself, a positive life for yourself in prison?
I think one of the first things that I have a real issue with was bullying.
Mm.
And to see, you know, in an environment where you don't have to worry about how you look, how you say something, particularly, you know, in the real world, you have to be very careful about how you approach this sort of stuff. In prison, it's literally, this isn't going to happen. You know, I wouldn't have that sort of around me. So I would tend to advocate on behalf of everybody that couldn't stand up for themselves, you know. Then it was a matter of the art of negotiation. So I would negotiate between different groups as to whether someone was going to be safe on the compound or not. It was, and it was also that when I first got there, there were hardly any women getting their parole, which, you know, was just crazy. And when I started listening to their stories and their language, it was like, yeah, probably not the best thing to say to a judge.
Yeah, right. Presentation.
Yep.
And their
hostility.
Right.
And they're not being heard. So I basically said to them, sit down, you tell me everything, I'll put it into a legal letter and I'll put it forth to the parole board. Most of them hadn't done programs because the program wasn't available to them, or they weren't allowed into the program, so therefore they didn't get their parole.
You know, the more marginalised you are, the further you are on the fringes of society, the harder it is to get in the middle, eh?
Absolutely. And so we started doing that, and I'd say to them, go in there, approach the judges, don't open your mouth. Just give them the letter. Right. And it went from about 3 girls getting parole out of 40 to about 38 getting parole out of 40. Now, this the thing with that is that the girls earned their parole. They could get back out with their children. They might come back, who knows. But they were getting their parole. They were being heard. So they were starting to – then it wasn't a far stretch to start to convince them to start coming to education, you know. So they started learning. They started doing programs, which, as we all know, makes them feel a lot better. Most of them had grade 3 education, you know.
Yeah.
So it was about making sure that the women were really heard. And I had that ability, you know. So I was never going to be one to sit there and just sit in the unit and –
sit and smoke outside.
Yeah.
So you got an education, you furthered your education.
I did my Master of Arts.
You got a master's in there. Yeah. And then you encouraged the other women to also pursue education as
absolutely.
You were.
Yep, yep. Because see, in prison, you know, again, I go to great pains to say that in prison, these sort of things are privileges, you know. Mm. If we want to do education, we have to be well behaved. We have to pay for it ourselves. We're not, you know, robbing the system, and we're not, you know, getting education that somebody on the outside could have got. You know, we've heard all of these stories. We had to earn it. And you know, trying to do a help with women, they're different in the sense that, you know, they have this girl, you know.
How many women do you think who went to prison have a drug addiction?
Oh, 70% at any time, you know. And I had not come from, it was the best drug education I ever had.
Yeah.
You know, I had never had any drug issues and whatnot. So seeing the girls and hearing their stories, you know, most of them, their primary school age was working on the streets and being raped every other day, you know.
Yeah.
Sexual abuse, it's just insane, you know. And behind these women are really, really lovely girls. And this was what I had the privilege of seeing. Some of them are bad.
Yeah.
Some of them just should be there and stay there. But that's not by far and above, that's not the majority of women there. And that was, again, what we tried to do in Wentworth, the first season, you know, was to show that these women aren't, you know, the prison isn't just about these animals locked away that have got no social skills, because what that does is then causes a community to think, well, they're right where they should be.
Yep.
You know, and that's just silly, because every woman gets out. And in my mind, if I'm getting out and I'm going to live next door to you, wouldn't you hope that while I was in prison, we did everything we could to make me a better person?
Yeah. Definitely.
It's just so simple in my mind. Mm. And seeing it from the inside as I have, and seeing it from the, you know, the outside as well, it makes even more sense that you invest instead of, you know, it's not sexy for politicians to say, I'm going to put money in prisons, you mm-hmm. know, it's which is just silly, absolutely silly.
Speaking of sexy, by the way, both Wentworth and Orange is the New Black
yep.
portray a lot of sex
yes.
in the prison. Yep. Is that yep. true?
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It's you know, there's a lot of different, you know, relationships as far as sex goes in prison.
Gay for the stay.
Yeah.
I've heard about that one. That's where you're not gay on the yep. outside, but yep. inside, sure.
The other one for gay for the stay or gate gays.
Gate gays.
So what happens is that once you arrive at the prison, you all of a sudden become gay.
Right.
Yeah. And when you leave, you go back to your boyfriend.
Yep.
There are a lot of women in there that had relationships with other women. And I used to sit and talk to them and say, you know, you got a boyfriend and whatnot. But they wanted, it wasn't about the sex. It was about having a loving relationship. Mm. It was about that sort of stuff. So I would say half of it was about just having a nurturing relationship with somebody. The other half of it was just rampant sex. But you get that anywhere, you know. It's,
yep.
it's just the average stay is probably around 3 years, you know. Women Whoa. Are women.
Yeah, yeah. Well, humans are humans. Yeah.
It's exactly right. So
what happens when the prison realises there's a relationship going on? Do they well, – is they it allowed or
– Well, when I was there, they just sort of tended to turn a blind eye, you know. There was no – it wasn't openly – you know, girls yeah. would walk around maybe hand in hand, but you wouldn't see them having sex in the middle of the compound, mm. you know. So if they were caught and it was somewhere public, you know, they'd be given a stern talking to. But other than that, you know, I think the officers there, you know, some of them – I only had an issue with one or two officers, you know.
Yeah.
The rest of them I thought were fabulous, you know, the way they dealt with women. They're different in the sense that, you know, they have a 6-week training course. So they related to a lot of the women. They would turn a blind eye to that sort of stuff anyway, mm-hmm. you know, which is because it's just a natural thing. Mm. Then there are other women in there, you know, that are just like myself that was heterosexual, and there's women in there that have, they're 15 years that wouldn't even think of it, you know. So it's just an amazing dynamic in there. It's a fascinating, fascinating place.
Yeah. In the series Wentworth, one of those early moments that Bea really thinks, where the hell am I, is when she swings around her doorway and that stunning girl who plays Frankie,
is
just going hell for leather with another girl in her bed, and she just kind of looks up and looks Bea in the eye, and it's a really powerful moment. Do you remember that moment for you in terms of that moment?
It was
exactly
that moment.
Was it really that?
Yes.
Wow.
This is how much, you know, I say about Wentworth being raised. It was literally that moment, and because as much as, you know, Frankie and Bea and whatnot, they're all, and Lizzie, they're all based on the prisoner people.
Yeah.
Because they've been re-imaged for the characters. They're also based on the real women in prison that were focal around me.
Mm.
And interestingly enough, they all slip into that because when it first aired, the girls from prison were Facebooking me and saying, you know, wow, I know who that is. That's that, you know.
I bet.
And my biggest concern was that they, you know, that I didn't disrespect them.
Mm.
And they loved the first series, you know. So that was exactly my, you know, I opened it and you know, I won't say who the woman was, but, you know, that, you know, I think the officers there, you know, some of them, I only had an issue with one or two officers, you know.
Yeah.
The rest of them I thought were fabulous, you know, the way they dealt with women. They're different in the sense that, you know, they have a 6-week training course. So they related to a lot of the women. They would turn a blind eye to that sort of stuff anyway, you know, which is because it's just a natural thing. Mm. Then there are other women in there, you know, that are just like myself that was heterosexual, and there's women in there that have, they're 15 years that wouldn't even think of it, you know. So it's just an amazing dynamic in there. It's a fascinating, fascinating place.
Yeah. In the series Wentworth, one of those early moments that Bea really thinks, where the hell am I, is when she swings around her doorway and that stunning girl who plays Frankie
is
just going hell for leather with another girl in her bed, and she just kind of looks up and looks Bea in the eye, and it's a really powerful moment. Do you remember that moment for you in terms of that moment?
It was
where you
exactly
thought,
that moment.
Was it really that?
Yes.
Wow.
This is how much, you know, I say about Wentworth being raised. It was literally that moment, and because as much as, you know, Frankie and Bea and whatnot, they're all, and Lizzie, they're all based on the prisoner people.
Yeah.
Because they've been re-imaged for the characters. They're also based on the real women in prison that were focal around me. And interestingly enough, they all slip into that because when it first aired, the girls from prison were Facebooking me and saying, you know, wow, I know who that is. That's that, you know.
I bet.
And my biggest concern was that they, you know, that I didn't disrespect them. Mm. And they loved the first series, you know. So that was exactly my, you know, I opened it and you know, I won't say who the woman was, but, you know, after that, she was, you know, pretty keen, pretty interested, you know, in me, and I was like, this is going to be great.
Was it scary?
Yes, it was because you're a nice
suburban lady from Healesville, and
I really didn't want to upset this girl because for a moment there I thought she was a man. Anyway,
wow, okay.
So, but we actually became friends, you know, and I remember at one point, you know, my first day there, and I was like, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking to myself, oh, I've been married. Not much scares me anymore. You know, if I can get through a marriage, any woman can get through a marriage. Yep. Prison's got to be easy. So, but one of the first days, there was a prisoner who'd been there, and she was very well known to the system and very well connected. And she came up and she said to me, give us your smokes. I went, oh, no, not really. No, I'm pretty keen to have one myself.
Mm.
And she, you know, long and short of it was that she was, you know, well, why don't we go outside? And I'm like, oh, no, thanks. I'm quite okay in here. She said, let's go outside. She said, and I just looked at her and went, and I just gave up. I thought, I'm in the worst place ever. I'm at there's no lower you can go apart from death.
Yep.
And I was standing there, I'm looking at this big woman, and I said to her, look, you know, we can go outside. You know, I'm not going to win. There is no doubt about this, but you're as sure as shit going to know you've been in a fight. You know, it was my only, and it was all mouth. I didn't mean that at all, but I'd heard it in a movie.
Wow.
And it just came to me, and she just looked at me and went, and everyone's watching then going, oh, what are we going to do? And she just looked at me and said, you're crazy, and walked off. And I thought, ah. So I was onto that from the word go.
Yeah.
You know.
You've got to have that bravado.
And, you know, look, I am not a shrinking violet, you know, so I was able to use that. The other thing is I have a bit of a sharp tongue when I need to have it. And no woman likes to look or be made a fool of in the compound. So if I found myself in a difficult situation, I'd make sure it was right in the compound.
Yeah.
And I had the ability to make them make a tough girl look stupid. And no one wanted that, so they'd sort of go. After a while, I started doing all of their, their parole letters and things like that. So I became their trusted confidant, you know, and very handy in that sense.
Yeah, because you weren't as marginalised as most women in there. You know, you hadn't come from an easy life, but certainly you're very well educated. You're very smart. You're very well spoken. You have a confidence about you, and you have real leadership skills. So how did you start to use those skills and sort of make a life for yourself, a positive life for yourself in prison?
I think one of the first things that I have a real issue with was bullying.
Mm.
And to see, you know, in an environment where you don't have to worry about how you look, how you say something, particularly, you know, in the real world, you have to be very careful about how you approach this sort of stuff. In prison, it's literally, this isn't going to happen. You know, I wouldn't have that sort of around me. So I would tend to advocate on behalf of everybody that couldn't stand up for themselves, you know. Then it was a matter of the art of negotiation. So I would negotiate between different groups as to whether someone was going to be safe on the compound or not. It was, and it was also that when I first got there, there were hardly any women getting their parole, which, you know, was just crazy. And when I started listening to their stories and their language, it was like, yeah, probably not the best thing to say to a judge.
Yeah, right. So their presentation.
Yep.
And their
hostility.
Right.
And they're not being heard. So I basically said to them, sit down, you tell me everything, I'll put it into a legal letter and I'll put it forth to the parole board. Most of them hadn't done programs because the program wasn't available to them, or they weren't allowed into the program, so therefore they didn't get their parole.
You know, the more marginalised you are, the further you are on the fringes of society, the harder it is to get in the middle, eh?
Absolutely. And so we started doing that, and I'd say to them, go in there, approach the judges, don't open your mouth, just give them the letter.
Right.
And it went from about 3 girls getting parole out of 40 to about 38 getting parole out of 40. Now, the thing with that is that the girls earned their parole. They could get back out with their children. They might come back, who knows, but they were getting their parole. They were being heard. So they were starting to – then it wasn't a far stretch to start to convince them to start coming to education, you know. So they started learning. They started doing programs, which, as we all know, makes them feel a lot better. Most of them had grade 3 education, you know.
Yeah.
So it was about making sure that the women were really heard. And I had that ability, you know. So I was never going to be one to sit there and just sit in the unit and –
sit and smoke outside.
Yeah.
So you got an education, you furthered your education.
I did my Master of Arts.
You got a Master's in there.
Yeah.
And then you encouraged the other women to also pursue education as
absolutely.
You were.
Yep. Because see, in prison, you know, again, I go to great pains to say that in prison, these sort of things are privileges, you know.
Mm.
If we want to do education, we have to be well behaved, we have to pay for it ourselves. We're not, you know, robbing the system, and we're not, you know, getting education that somebody on the outside could have got. You know, we've heard all of these stories. We had to earn it. And you know, trying to do a Master of Arts in prison when you don't have a computer and you've got the dog squad ramping your unit every day can be a bit tricky. Mm. So, you know, we really earned our degrees, and it was one of the first full graduation ceremonies that came into the prison.
Wow.
The rest of the prison was so proud, you know, that we were able to do this, because no one thought we'd be able to do it. On the outset, it was a sort of a little bit of a study, you know. So we all went on and got our degrees, and, you know, and it set a new culture in there for learning, particularly with the women. Some women just need to know what their rights are.
Yeah.
You know, some women have given up so much in their heart that they'll accept anything, you know. And my point of view is, I see it from both sides. If you're in prison, that's a consequence. That's you just pucker up, you know.
Yeah.
But while you're in there, the time needs to be useful, you know, to work on these women. You got a captive audience. When I was there, there was no domestic violence programs. We lost women. They would leave straight after. They'd go straight back to the same abusive man, and they were eventually killed. Yet I'm thinking, you know, you've got a captive audience. They're not going anywhere.
And they've got that time away from their life to be able to look back on it.
Yes, and to be able to work changes on them. And you never know, you know. Yeah. You know, you never know what you can change within a person. I've seen so many women change, just get up one day and go, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to try and do this and I'm going to try and do that, you know. I keep in touch with a lot of the women, you know, on the outside, and they're all doing really well. Some have, you know, issues. You know, that's always going to be the case. You know, you've got to allow for recidivism. If the community is going to shun these women and they're not going to let them become part of the community again, then why would they bother abiding by the community's laws? Mm. Why would they, you know, if they're feeling so alienated, that's right, why should they, you know? You can't have two bites of the cherry, you know.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you've got to accept that women they go to prison. Your loss of freedom is huge. It is amazingly huge. You don't then get a double dip and go, well, we want you to do 5 years in there as well, but we want you to go and break rocks as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You can't say how your sentence can be run. You have your contribution to the sentence, but then in prison, your loss of freedom, and until you've had that loss, you don't realise just what it's about. And prison never leaves you. Oh. An experience in prison never leaves you.
I'm Michelle Laurie, and you are right in the middle of the Nitty Gritty Committee. Thank you for downloading. It's all brought to you by Car City Ringwood. Prison does change you, and it changed you enormously. When you entered prison, you were, you know, not only a very unhappy woman and a confused woman and all of that, you also had an undiagnosed mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you came out of prison, was it 4.5, 5 years later?
Yep.
Your mental illness was under control. You had a master's. You were on your way to a PhD. You were very well thought of within the system, and you'd created programs in the system. How did you reconcile, though, with your kids, your family, and the victims of your crime?
Yeah. Victims of the crime, I don't have anything to do with.
Sure.
In my mind, again, and this is not being disrespectful, but in my mind, they, you know, attended the trial. They got their victim impact statements heard. I got my sentence and I've done what I've had to do. I didn't appeal my sentence and I did the whole thing in maximum security so nobody could say, you know, oh, she was trying to get out of it. I didn't. I copped it full on. I could have got my sentence reduced. Maybe.
Have you ever run into them? Have they ever tried to contact you?
No.
Okay.
No. And as I say, that's my sentence done.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole host of reasons that, you know, I can't go into.
Okay.
Why they wouldn't contact me, and I certainly don't need to contact them. As I said, I've done my sentence. When it come to the children, I remember the last day that I had a visit with them in the visit centre, and they left, and I'm like, Mummy's coming home now. Mummy's coming home. And in prison, you're not involved in the outside, so you've got no idea what's going on out there and you can't even put your head out there. So I could see that they were apprehensive and I was like, why? You know, but I had no idea that they were very settled with their dad. They were having a good life, you know, they'd moved on as well. I'm just sitting there waiting, counting down the days until I get out with them. Mummy's coming back. I didn't see that they were going, oh, no.
Yeah.
And that hurt me terribly. And it took me a little bit of time to work that out. I remember sitting in the visit centre after they left thinking, oh, my God, that's it. This is happening. And I didn't want to leave.
Wow.
I didn't want to leave. And then when the first day I was out and I had some time with the girls, we went to a shopping centre. And
God, that must have been sensory overload.
It was because I remember standing there, the girls were, you know, having a bit of a play and all that sort of stuff. And I had to pay for something. And I remember standing there looking at the FPOS machines and they'd changed that much.
Yeah.
And I had a card, obviously. And I was looking over this person's shoulder, looking at what they were doing. I'm sure they thought I was going to hold them up.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's all I need. I'm on parole. I'll be back there by tonight. But I was trying to see how it worked.
Yeah.
You know, I had – and then the girl started arguing. I had no idea what to do. I didn't know how to control the situation. it was upsetting me because it was like, I've just come home. Oh, my God, why are you arguing sort of thing? They were being normal kids.
Yep.
I didn't know how to reprimand them because, you know, I didn't want to be home after all that time and be into them. You know,
yeah.
it was really, 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 really difficult. It's taken a long time. As I've always said, people, you know, that have never been involved with a traumatic life or prison or crime or anything like that, often say, you know, a mother's love can never be broken, sort of thing. And I get that, but the bond certainly can. Mm. The bond can be broken. It takes a long time. The girls were used to not seeing me, and I was used to not seeing them.
And they were certainly used to you not being an authority figure in their lives.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, so, you know, it took a long time, a little of push and shove and give and take and whatnot as they grew up, you know. And I wasn't about to step into the relationship that they had with their dad. You know, he was there when I wasn't. He was a stable influence when I wasn't. He was a terrific father. And I'm very, very lucky and very fortunate for that. So I wasn't about to step in and go, okay, mum's back. Let's hop into family court. It's the only one I haven't covered.
Yeah. Really?
No, I have, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, so, you know, they didn't need that. They just needed me to work in around them. And that, you know, these girls were, I used to hold their hand when they still crossed, you know, when they crossed the road when I left them. And these were young adults now. So, you know, it's hard talking to people and they're your own. I used to sit there and look at them and go, oh, my God, these are my daughters, but I don't, who are you talking about? You know, I had no idea who their friends were, you know, what they'd done on the different weekends. It was just so difficult. I grew up with them on the phone. So I'm very aware of their emotions. So I had 6 minutes with each of them twice a week on the phone. That's all. Wow. The family court awarded me 24 hours a year to see the children, you know. So it was just ridiculous.
In 6 minutes, if you're lucky, you maybe get them to admit there's something wrong with them, and then you can't complete the conversation.
No, it's just crazy. So, but I could hear in their voice, you know, it went from, you know, hey, mum. You know, these tiny little, hey, mum. And then it was on to you know, hi, mum, and whatever else. And then, yo, you know, over the
little what? Kids, yeah, with over little, the years. I've got five-year-old twins, and with little kids, you're still so in tune with
yes,
them. You know,
yeah.
You can read their little thoughts and,
yeah.
You know, you're still so bonded.
Yes. Yeah.
I can't imagine losing that and not being able to see a conversation through with them when I know they're troubled.
Yes. That was my point. I had to try and show and try and work out how I could keep this connection.
Mm.
And it was listening. I'd literally press the phone into my ear, and you see that in Wentworth a lot.
Yeah.
Press it into my ear because I'm trying to listen. Is she trying not to cry? Is she happy? Yeah. Was that a whimper? Was that, you know? So I got very in tune with listening to them and listening to them grow up. You know, it's very, very difficult, very, very difficult when you're away from your children from that long. And particularly in prison, you've got to steel yourself. You bring in new emotions that you never realised that you had. And that's what I refer to when I talk about how it becomes part of you.
Oh, people talk about being an I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and how intense the emotional journey is because I'm isolated and I can't see my family.
Yep.
I can't imagine what prison for 5 years.
The other thing is that it was like... not being able to go and pick up the phone, not being able to open a door, not being able to do this and the other. It's once you realise the degree of hopelessness, then you realise you can't change the unchangeable. I can't do this, so I've just got to get it in my head, I can't do this. And that. So in the end, you start to work out, okay, I can't do that, so don't worry about it. And you become quite ruthless with your own emotions.
Yeah.
I remember with the girls, you know, each time they left, particularly the first time they left the visit centre, you know, I started to cry and I thought, if I do this, I could feel that I would never come back from it.
Yeah.
That if I let go, I'm going to be this blubbering mess for the next 5 years sitting in a corner rocking to and fro, you know.
Yeah.
I just knew that I wouldn't be able to claw my way back if I didn't. So I just sort of was like, right, okay. And you steel your emotions. That's what you have to do. And you put it, you compartmentalize and you put it out of your mind. You don't think about it again until you need to address it for the phone situation or visits again or whatnot. So it's really difficult, and you really need to live off those emotions. It's no place for the weak.
No.
No place for the weak at all.
So you've been out of prison, would it be 4 or 5 years now?
Six.
6 years. What's your life like now? What does it look like?
It's really busy. I do a lot of, you know, public speaking and
just open doors whenever you feel like it. Get on the phone whenever you feel like it.
I do what I like.
Yeah. God, what an amazing feeling.
It is. It's,
do you still have moments where you think, I can do whatever I like?
Absolutely. And sometimes, you know, it's when I talk, sometimes I deal with things quite harshly on the outside as well, because I still tap into those emotions.
Yeah, I bet.
They're so ingrained that they kept you alive, that it's pretty hard to just, you know, let them go. But the ability of just being able to do what you want when you want is huge. The simple things in life are what you appreciate. Mm. You know, nothing else matters. It really doesn't. Once you've been deprived of absolutely everything, it nothing else matters. To be able to sit, you know, and look at a mobile phone. Yeah. You know, when I went in, there wasn't any picture messaging, you know.
Yeah, technology moves fast.
And I went out. I know. Amazingly. That was the biggest thing that I noticed. And I was sitting at a restaurant outside having a glass of wine when I got out thinking, this is great. And my ex-husband sent me a text and I looked at it and I was like, I couldn't understand it. And I just looked at everyone and went, oh, clearly he's drunk. And it was the new text type.
Yeah,
I couldn't read
it. He's giving you lols and
I couldn't read. I was drunk. And I was like, oh. You know, and I'm standing there sort of going, yeah, say what I have to put up with.
Yeah.
So I do, you know, I'm not involved with Wentworth anymore.
Okay,
so,
the show, right. But you still do a lot of corporate speaking and
absolutely,
and all of that stuff. And you're a university lecturer.
Yes, yeah, in media.
In media.
Yeah, well, it's good to have experience on both sides, you know.
It's incredible experience.
As a practitioner, one of the things was, you know, I remember when I was arrested, you know, and the paper actually had Tucker behind bars and I read it and I was like, oh. And I was thinking, the community must be sitting there going, oh, thank God. But who is she?
You know, absolutely.
It was the only time I saw, the other time I saw that was Mockville behind bars.
Yeah.
And I thought, so, you know, it was this huge, huge thing. And it was, and it occupied all of the newspapers and it had, you know, mum of two, you know, it wasn't like, you know, the reporting was quite different to how you would report a mail, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's like a double conviction because you know, why weren't you at home with your children, you know, because you're a woman, you do get it. And unfortunately, I had a woman judge as well. So,
She was not sympathetic?
Oh, gosh, no.
Oh.
No. That was, you know, I knew from the outset I was dead in the water.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. I think because she may well have mentioned it on the first day.
You're dead in the water.
Pretty much.
Oh, gosh.
Interestingly enough. But, you know, I know a lot of judges. I do a lot of speaking, you know. And I do a lot of work for Wear for Success. I'm their Australian ambassador and the patron for VACRO, which Justice Harper is also patron for them. Two amazing, amazing services in the community that look after, you know, particularly women, but offenders that are trying to reintegrate into the community. It's a community service because it assists the community.
Yeah.
In assisting these people,
yes,
it assists the community. It's a win-win. And it's a really big thing for busy, busy people to get out of their way and actually look after people that no one else want to know.
Well, on that, there'll be people listening to this conversation who think, I want to do something to help. How can other people help?
I think Wear for Success.
Yep,
absolutely.
Okay.
They're always looking for volunteers. They do such a magnificent job, you know. Mm-hmm. They really, really do.
Donating clothes or time?
Yeah, and
money?
Time and services, you
Great.
Know, anything at all. You know, they do a lot of programs. It's a fabulous organisation. And you know, we like to hook in with women coming out of prison, so they have that. And they have these people to sit and talk to as well. That's half the thing. Loneliness is very, very destructive, and women particularly, you know, I can't speak for men, but women particularly suffer this when they get out, whether it's because of themselves or whether it's because of the community isolating them or having no money to be able to be involved in the community. Either one is very, very destructive. A lot of women like to go back to prison for that reason. You know, I was out 3 days and wanted to go back. I was out 3 days and, at 3:30, they're doing muster now. I know exactly where the girl, you know, I wanted to go back. It's, you know, getting out of prison is much harder than going to prison, I can assure you. You know, it's really, really difficult because most people have that stigma you know, they're judged very, very, very quickly. I wasn't in that sense. I was very, very, you know, fortunate. Not many people get out of prison and step straight into a university.
You were a great prison success story as well. So they were very proud of you. And
yeah, and right? It's very important then to be able to raise the issues where it's a win-win situation. Mm. You know, VACRO are just, again, a fabulous, fabulous organisation, and both are full of people that really want to make a difference, that really want to help. You know, these people, you know, marginalised people, whether it be refugees, whether it be homeless, you know, VACRO deals with offenders, but Where for Success deals with everyone. So, you know, and women offenders and men offenders. So, you know, both of those organisations, absolutely, I couldn't speak more highly of them. Very, very proud to be their ambassador.
That is the force of nature known as Kerry Tucker. And you can keep up with Kerry's ongoing achievements by following her on Twitter. I believe there is a book coming very, very soon, so you want to make sure you're onto that. She's at Kerry Tucker 307. Just Google her if you can't remember that. It's K-E-R-R-Y, Kerry Tucker. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. And thank you for rating us on iTunes and joining us on Facebook.
Australian True Crime, the live show, is coming.